Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Here's what my guest for the hour, Aaron Gruhl, writes. When I walked into my first class as a new teacher, I could not have been less prepared to deal with the harsh realities in the lives of my students or the way the outside world would crash into my classroom. These teenagers lived in a racially divided community and were already hardened by firsthand exposure to gang violence, broken homes, juvenile halls, and drugs. The obstacles these teens confronted as students became challenges for me as their teacher. We're talking about room 203 at Woodrow Wilson High School in Long Beach, California, in 1994 and the next several years. And this extraordinary story is chronicled in the Freedom Writer's Diary, how a teacher and 150 teens used writing to change themselves and the world around them. Aaron Gruhl is my guest for the hour. She's coming to Utah State University, be appearing tonight at 7 o'clock in the Taggart Student Center Stevenson Ballroom on the Utah State University campus. That's an evening presented by the Utah State University Emma Eccles Jones College of Education and Human Services. It's called A Night with Aaron Gruhl, the Freedom Writer's Diary. Aaron Gruhl, a pleasure to welcome you to Access Utah.
Oh, it's such an honor. I'm just so honored to not only be in your state, but to be able to talk to educators and community members and students as well.
I want to hear some of the aspects of this extraordinary story, but perhaps starting with your background. You grew up in California area, did you?
I did. And actually, when I began teaching, I was teaching at a school that was hard hit by the Los Angeles riots. So it's ironic that we're on the cusp of the 20th anniversary of the Rodney King verdict. And so where I was living couldn't be more different than where my students were from. I lived in Newport Beach, this beautiful seaside, very affluent community. And to go from where I was living into the inner city was quite a difference of a culture shock of sorts. Mm.
Your father had an interesting background. He was a minor leaguer for the Washington Senators, right?
Worked in professional baseball his entire life. He played, he coached, and he was also a professional baseball scout. So my whole life I was surrounded by baseball players and this concept that, it's a very big world. My father always impressed upon all of us the importance of travel. And I have to thank him for my namesake. He named me in honor of Hank Aaron, which I took really seriously about all the things that Hank Aaron did, the strides he took to help desegregate baseball. So with that, I always felt like I had these really big shoes to fill.
Mm-hmm. And your father, I guess, would tell you stories about the segregation that his teammates faced when they would play in the South.
Yeah, absolutely. Growing up in Southern California, which is this microcosm of so many different ethnicities and cultures, I couldn't fathom a time where folks couldn't drink at the same drinking fountains or ride on the same bus or even eat at the same lunch counters. So to have my father experience that with players that he revered, my father was a catcher, he said it was really difficult. He himself grew up in California. And when he rode through the Deep South with a lot of the players to witness their treatment firsthand, he said it was just so disheartening. And, I'm just blessed. And all kids who have been born since the Civil Rights Movement have been blessed to see the effects of integration when it works. But I couldn't even fathom a time when there was such blatant segregation.
Now, your father one time wanted to be a teacher, in fact, was a teacher and a baseball coach, and then he got into scouting. But I guess when you were getting ready to go to college, you wanted to be a lawyer.
I did want to be a lawyer. Something my father being this self-proclaimed civil rights activist, as he got a little older and a little more successful, and suddenly he was driving a convertible Mercedes and we were living in a gated community. It seemed like the only handicap he would talk about was his golf score. So he was convinced that the only way for me to afford this lifestyle that I was now accustomed to was to go off to the university and to become a lawyer. And being this dutiful daughter, that's exactly what I intended. And I'm so glad I made that shift. I'm glad I made that shift for the right reasons. you know, really early on, I wanted to fight battles in a classroom and not just in a courtroom. And so I'm so thankful that I had that opportunity to do so.
By the way, Erin Gruhl's memoir is Teach from the Heart, and some very interesting stories in that memoir. Interesting read along with the Freedom Writer's Diary. So at University of California, Irvine, you had an interesting experience viewing, as we all did, that courageous young man facing down the tank at Tiananmen Square.
You know, it's ironic. I've been so blessed to go to so many universities, and I remember vividly being this college student who had never really stood up for anything. I you know, done all the right things by being involved with student activities and sports and student government and even cheerleading and being a sorority. So I always felt that I was part of a team, and in many senses probably a follower. And when I witnessed that young boy stand in front of that tank in Tiananmen Square, it was really stirring. And I thought, here is somebody standing up for something that is so much bigger, whether it's democracy or freedom or even just the power of education. And at that moment, it made me realize, you know, stand up for something, Erin. And I never envisioned that when you take on this battle of education that oftentimes it feels like you're standing in front of a tank, because there's so many feelings entrenched with education and issues of equality in our country. And so I didn't realize that I would be standing in front of a tank when I took on the kind of students that I took on and the environment that I took on. But it's been an amazing ride. Because I stood up for those kids and because I stood up for equality, I've had death threats, believe it or not. I've had radio shock jocks try to criticize my student's book, The Freedom Writer's Diary. And we even had, if you can believe it, the grand dragon of a certain sect of the Ku Klux Klan actually took on our book and sent it to the FBI and claimed that Freedom Writer's Diary was pornography. And in all of those cases, I never envisioned that I would have to fight these battles in courtrooms or in the court of public opinion. And what I've come to find out is apparently the best way to get a teenager to read a book is to try to ban it. Because every time there was some kind of controversy, teenagers and teachers really rallied together and rallied for our book to be taught in their classrooms and in their communities.
So we like to think we live in a post-racial society, but there's still those strains out there.
You know, there is. And what I found one of the most despairing things about traveling, I've been to all 50 states since the book has come out, which has been a real gift to travel our country and to go to over 1,000 schools. And, you know, when you're in the halls of academia, you're taught that separate is not equal. You know, we found that with a Supreme Court ruling of Brown versus Board of Education. And so I think idealistically, I went into teaching believing in that separate is not equal and that schools should be more integrated. And in certain cases, they are. And tragically, in many cases, they're not. I have seen schools in every urban community, in every state of our nation, that are still segregated. I was in a school, ironically, just on Thursday in California, in our nation's capital, Sacramento. And of the 200 young students I saw at the high school, there was about 98% of those kids were African American. I did not see one Caucasian student. And I know it was a great school, and it was actually a school that is a charter school trying to get these young kids into college. But it just made me sad that in 2012, we still have schools that can be made up of one racial component. And I've seen that wherever I've traveled, whether it's a school that's predominantly Latino or a school that's predominantly Asian or a school that's predominantly Caucasian. And so I'm still fighting that battle. I believe that when diverse worlds come together, that beauty is inevitable. And I've seen that beauty. And that beauty was really evident with my students that were very mixed and very integrated. But I think people are still nervous about others and still nervous about differences. And I think public education is one of those great bastions of bringing people together and equalizing a very unfair playing field.
I want to have you talk a little bit about how you changed your plans from being a lawyer to being a teacher. And as a reading in your memoir, I was reading this next section very much from the point of view of your father, who I'm sure you write, and I'm sure he was distressed.
I call my father the lovable curmudgeon throughout the book.
And first of all, that you ended up engaged to an architecture student, at least that's what his prospective plans were, with four of his roommates, and your plans were sort of in limbo at that time.
It's so funny. I remember making that phone call to my dad. Hey, Dad, I'm starting graduate school, and I'm going to live with five guys. He didn't take the news so well, and it was kind of this organized chaos. I became a den mother. But the irony of being this den mother for these five guys was when I began teaching, I had these huge athletes, you know, kids who were 6'5" and 250, and I think having that experience of living with guys and having a father that was in professional sports, it gave me the anecdotes I needed to really try to engage my students. You know, I could talk the talk. I knew every football team and every baseball team and every basketball team, and I think that was disarming for my students. You know, they saw this crazy gal from the suburbs with polka dots and pearls, and they just assumed that I wasn't going to be able to relate to them. And so to be able to talk, you know, statistics and data about Monday Night Football in many cases was a saving grace for me.
Mm. Then a turning point for you, I think, and you're right, the Rodney King, the riots in response to the Rodney King verdict. And as you mentioned, that we have the anniversary coming up. It was the 29th of April, 1992.
It's great. You know, it's ironic. Living in California, like, so we're such, very much like Utah, we're, you know, we're a very diverse state. And I remember watching the riots, not only on television, but you could literally look out your window in living in Southern California, and no matter where you were, you could smell the ash, and you could see the smoke billowing in the sky and realize it was so close and yet so far away. When you live in Newport Beach, it is this nirvana, this utopia. And I guess I never realized, living in Newport Beach up until that moment, how homogeneous my community was. Newport Beach is predominantly Caucasian. It's very affluent. And I didn't realize that until I could turn on the television and watch what was happening in downtown Los Angeles and in Long Beach, and realize that I lived in this bubble and I lived in this cocoon. And I think that that happens a lot in these very affluent communities. You have this false sense of security. And so I think the riots for me was this very jarring experience, because what I was watching was young people led by a father or an older brother or an uncle teaching these kids how to throw a Molotov cocktail at a Circuit City and encouraging these kids to go in and loot. And that desperation they must have felt and that mayhem. And I realized, in reflection, all the lessons that I had learned from my father about rolling up my sleeves and fighting the good fight, or wanting to fight for the underdog. And this concept of fighting is universal. There's that, you know, everyone has that instinct of fight or flight. But I realized at that moment, I think there are battles that are worth fighting. Obviously, these kids are on the margins. Obviously, these kids know what it feels like to be racially profiled and to be poor and to feel invisible. But how can I make these kids feel like they matter and feel like they have a voice and feel that they can fight back, but fight back with words and not with weapons? And that's really when the idea of teaching literature and finding substantive stories that could give young people a voice really was crystallized for me.
If you just joined us, we're talking with Aaron Gruhl, who is with the Freedom Riders Foundation. In fact, more information at freedomridersfoundation.org. She founded that foundation after her experience in the 1990s in a classroom, Classroom 203, in Woodrow Wilson High School in Long Beach, California. Freedom Riders Diary, How a Teacher and 150 Teens Used Writing to Change Themselves and the World Around Them, is one book. Writing, or Teach from the Heart, is her memoir. And Aaron Gruhl will be on the Utah State University campus tonight at 7 o'clock. A Night with Aaron Gruhl, the Freedom Riders Diary. It's open to everyone. It's in the Taggart Student Center Stevenson Ballroom on the Utah State University campus, presented by Utah State University's M. Eccles Jones College of Education and Human Services. We're pleased to have Aaron Gruhl with us for the hour. We're on tape in this part of the program, so no calls or emails. So you decided that the place where you could have an influence would be in the classroom. And I think you further decided, well, let me go to a place where I can really have an impact. And you did end up in a place where I think the statistic was in that year, 1994, was it 100 gang-related murders in Long Beach, California?
Absolutely. There's a little bit over 100, about 126 murders. And I say that because that became the norm for my students. They were numb. They were anesthetized. And I think when you feel like you walk through life with a bullseye on your chest, or you know what it feels like to be a pallbearer at multiple funerals, or you know what it feels like to bury friends and family members, and that was the norm. There's an amazing young woman who I write about and is also the basis of one of the main characters in the feature film Freedom Riders. Her name in reality is Maria. In the feature film, we named her Ava. And she made this very flippant comment one time that she'd been to more funerals than birthday parties. And to be able to make a comment like that when you were 14 years old, and she said this while she was wearing an ankle monitor, while she had a probation officer, while she had a rap sheet, and this mentality of, it's a matter of time. It's just a matter of time before I screw up again, and I'm back behind bars, just like my daddy and my granddaddy before that. And that was the norm. A young boy named Darius, who we named Marcus in the feature film, in response to that, he made a comment that he felt like he lives in an undeclared war. And it's those gripping statements that are real, that young 14-year-olds who are in ninth grade don't foresee a future. They thought, I'm going to drop out of school by the time I'm 15. I'll be behind bars by the time I'm 16, and I will probably be 6 feet under by the time I'm 18. And that was really, in their minds, their destiny and their course of action. And so the idea of looking at this crazy English teacher from suburbia with her white polka dots and her white pearls and a syllabi that talked about Shakespeare and sonnets and Homer and an Odyssey was such a disconnect, because in their mind, Shakespeare wasn't going to put food on their table, and Homer wasn't going to protect them out on the streets or help that hardworking single mom who's just trying to make ends meet. And so I think for all of us, it was this uphill battle, because I realized my kids were miserable. They had never read a book from cover to cover. They hated reading. They hated writing. I quickly learned that they hated me. And so that was really my first full immersion into Room 203 and this reality of everything I learned in the university is not helping me. I know literature and I know stories. And how am I going to get these young people who've never even read about green eggs and ham to pick up a book and to find themselves?
And this is supposed to be student teaching, right? You're paying for the privilege to be here, and your mentor, so-called, disappears.
Absolutely. That happens a lot in education. I think that, many universities are blessed to be able to partner with public schools and allow, these dynamic and type A college students to get in and stick their pinky toe into the water. And I had a full immersion on day one. I remember walking in, and my master teacher went to get a cup of coffee, and I didn't see until the end of the semester. And so from that first day on, I was pretty much given full reins to try to work with kids who were still grappling with the effects of the riots and still grappling with everything that comes from feeling like an other and the sheer effects of abject poverty, where when you're a teenager, it's really embarrassing to let your friends and colleagues know that I can't afford breakfast or lunch. And so what I learned is in elementary school and middle school, most kids were on free and reduced lunch. And so everybody was eating and everybody was poor, and that was okay. But there was something very difficult about being a high school student and cashing in that meal ticket. And so I had these very proud kids who wouldn't even cash in their meal ticket to get that hot breakfast or to get that lunch. And that just added insult to injury when you've got kids who are hungry and angry and willing to put up their dukes for everything. They are fighting everything. They are fighting the system. And I realized that I represented the system. I was the man.
Could you tell us a little bit about Woodrow Wilson High, the atmosphere there in 1994? I understand this; it's located somewhat near an affluent area, but it the bus busing they'd bus students in.
What I've learned, you know, from having the opportunity to travel the United States is, like so many urban areas, oftentimes there's what is called facetiously this idea of white flight, where folks will leave that metropolitan area and go towards the suburbs or go towards school districts that feel a little safer. And ironically, Wilson High was this beautiful school. It still is a beautiful school in a suburban community. The problem is that the city of Long Beach has 98,000 kids, and in certain areas of this very large urban city, there was more kids in a geographical region than the school could handle. And so the school opened up this school of choice policy and this idea that within this city, you can go to any of the five high schools. And so in certain areas where there were many more African-American and Latino and Asian students, based on the kind of single-family homes being turned into apartment complexes, a lot of these kids thought, you know, I live in a war zone. I live in the housing projects, and so I'm already fighting a war, you know, when I'm not in school. So if I can get on a bus or three buses or five buses and go across town and go to a school that appears to be in a better neighborhood, at least that war will stop from 7 to 3. And so what happened was many, many students and or their parents made this decision that if all of the choices within this community, Wilson seemed to be the safest and Wilson seemed to be the nicest. And what happened is all of these kids opted to take those buses and travel across town and go to a school that had one point been this Harvard of high schools, and it had one point been predominantly this affluent Caucasian school. And suddenly it changed. It changed overnight. I think people's fears got the best of them. And, you know, following the Los Angeles riots, there was just a lot of discussions about race and people not really knowing their place in this discussion. And so what I didn't realize is that Wilson High was in this transition of people leaving, people coming. And when these kids came to this new school, not feeling they were accepted and feeling alienated. And so Wilson High was really in a transition.
And in fact, it's quite the picture, as you write in your memoir. The kids segregated themselves, right? Not only in class, but during lunch period, it was all in separate groups.
They did. And I've noticed that phenomenon. Wherever I've traveled, I think that oftentimes people want a comfort zone. And unfortunately, when you're 14 and you're not very sophisticated, talk about philosophy and all that good stuff, the comfort zone became race. The comfort zone became your gang affiliation or your posse or your tagging crew. And so you could literally walk around this enormous quad at lunch and see the segregation, it was palpable. And that segregation that was on the quad permeated into the classrooms. And so, you know, in one corner would sit all the African Americans, and in another corner would sit all the Latinos, and in another corner sat all the Asians. And I think that our feature film tried to capture that, about just the way things felt and looked, and even that when I tried to dismantle the comfort zones within my classroom, I think that was also really evident.
And most of the white kids in something called the Distinguished Scholars Program, I think.
That was an attempt by neighborhood parents to keep their kids still going to a public school, but this idea of to keep them safe. And so what happened is this Distinguished Scholars Program came from a program that started with these local elementary and middle school in that community. And it was kind of this way to usher these kids through an academic program together. Unfortunately, if you would walk down the hallway, for example, if you walk down my hallway, my classroom, and any given period, if I had 35 students, I would have between 33 and 34 African-American, Latino, and Asian students, and I may have one or two Caucasians per period. If you look literally directly across the hallway at the Distinguished Scholars classroom, not only did they have new textbooks, not only did they have computers, which I had neither, they would have 33 to 34 Caucasians, and maybe an African-American per period, or maybe a Latino per period. And I just remember how jarring that was to be able to have these two classrooms literally across the hall from one another and to see that kind of separation.
It struck me as you were talking earlier about some of the kids, Maria and Darius, all they've ever known is... is this life? And I'm wondering if expectations is one of the keys, especially expectations they have of themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what's been so amazing about our story going full circle is what the students and I feel the most passionate about is going into places, whether they are juvenile halls, psychiatric wards, wherever, and looking at those same kinds of kids who can look at my students and say, oh my God, I look like you, I talk like you, and I come from a place that you come from. And what I am so excited about is following the event this evening, on Thursday, I have the ability to go to a school in Utah that is a lockdown psychiatric facility for minors. And those kids have very similar stories to my student stories, right, in your state. And so to be able to have that candid conversation with these kids in Utah is going to be incredibly emotional for me and very, very moving and gripping. But I think for my students, as with many students, they watch their parents in their minds fail, and they watch their parents make bad decisions and bad choices. And For many of my kids, actually most of my kids, there wasn't a father in the home. And so that deadbeat dad maybe out on a street corner drinking out of a brown paper bag, or that deadbeat dad maybe behind bars, or that deadbeat dad, unfortunately, maybe 6 feet under. And so there wasn't a lot of traditional, solid male role models for my students. For these mothers, there was these two camps. There was a lot of moms who were proud, incredibly proud. So they would have these two or three jobs, you know, cleaning homes and scrubbing toilets in hotels and working in sweatshops, you know, sewing beautiful dresses. So those proud, proud moms who were gone for 15 to 20 hours a day, or other mothers who were so demoralized that they became a part of this system. And with that system came this mentality of it's never going to get better. And so that was something I really had to understand and try to bring these mothers into my program and to not alienate them and not to judge them, and to truly show them that if you've made bad choices, that doesn't make you a bad person. But we dubbed this group of women, I'm so proud of this name that we came up, we call them the Dream Team Moms. And all of these years later, this group of women, whether they were housekeepers, whether they were stay-at-home moms, have really risen to the occasion. They've gone back to get GEDs. They've gone back to community colleges. They've gone back to get bachelor's degrees. And I think they embraced education because their sons and daughters embraced education and became these mama's cheerleaders. And I think that's one of the most exciting things for me is every time one of those mamas graduates, it's amazing.
If you just joined us, we're talking with Erin Gruhl. You may have seen the movie Freedom Riders. Erin Gruhl was played by Hilary Swank in that movie. The book is The Freedom Riders Diary, How a Teacher and Her 150 Teens Used Riding to Change Themselves and the World Around Them. That's The Freedom Riders with Erin Gruhl. Her memoir is Teach from the Heart. And Erin Gruhl is coming to Utah State University. She'll be on the USU campus tonight at 7 o'clock. In the Taggart Student Center Stevenson Ballroom on the USU campus. Everyone is welcome to this evening call tonight with Erin Gruhl, The Freedom Riders Diary. It's presented by the Utah State University M. Eccles Jones College of Education and Human Services. And we're going to take a brief break, then back with Erin Gruhl for the hour.
Hi, this is Blair Larson, host of Fresh Folk. On the show this week, I feature the folk bluegrass album from Rita Hosking and the affecting new album from Vance Gilbert. I'll also play songs from new releases by Greg Engel, Kate Campbell, and Jenny Bieneman, to name just a few. Tune in and listen this Saturday at 8 p.m. to Fresh Folk on Utah Public Radio.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
We're talking with Erin Gruhl on this part of the, actually for the entire hour. And she, along with the Freedom Riders themselves, wrote the Freedom Riders Diary, How a Teacher and 150 Teens Used Riding to Change Themselves and the World Around Them. The memoir is Teach from the Heart. And Erin Gruhl will be on the Utah State University campus tonight. It's an evening with Erin Gruhl, 7 p.m., Taggart Student Center, Stevenson Ballroom on the Utah State University campus. Admission is free. And by the way, all attendees are asked to bring a can of food to donate to the local food bank. As presented by Utah State University Emma Eccles Jones College of Education and Human Services. Erin Gruhl, if you don't know the story or watched the movie Freedom Riders, as a student teacher in 1994 and for the next several years, encountered racially segregated by themselves students who, as they say, they agreed on three things. They hated the school. They hated, I can't remember what it was, and they hated their teacher. They hated learning.
Yes, they did.
Right. They hated books. They hated their teacher.
I think the word hate permeated everything. They hated reading, writing, education. I think the hate for me was the one chord that brought them together in perfect harmony initially.
And Erin Gruhl writes on the website freedomridersfoundation.org, the 150 freshmen who drifted into room 203 in Woodrow Wilson High School in Long Beach, California, already had been dubbed the students' rejects. And sure enough, that hurtful judgment was reiterated several weeks later when I was told, says Erin Gruhl, that my students were too stupid to read a book from cover to cover. Of course, the story turned out much differently, and we're pleased to have Erin Gruhl with us for the hour. I wanted to have you talk about a key incident that happened. This is Sherrod. I'll have you tell me about Sherrod and a note that was passed around about him.
Absolutely. There's been these moments of serendipity, or that I couldn't have meticulously planned a lesson plan any greater, and that was one of those moments. Sherrod's background is incredibly interesting. Sherrod was a young boy who was born to a teenage mother. Did not really have a relationship with his father. His father was, strung out and his deadbeat dad. his mom went on to have several more sons from several more suitors. And through all of that, you know, living in the housing projects, being homeless, and everything that goes with having a mother who is a teenager and not prepared to raise a family full of kids, Sherrod learned that instinct really early on about fight or flight. And while he was a great track star, he was a better fighter. And there was an incident at his previous high school that he attended where he threatened an English teacher with a gun. He actually brought the gun to school and planned to use it on this English teacher. The gun was never recovered. And lo and behold, he is switched to my school and walks in with a saunter and bouncing a basketball and this attitude and this swagger. And the banter in the teacher's lounge was, you know, this kid's going to blow up the school. You know, this kid is trouble. Just send him away. And quite honestly, he was trouble. He was desperate and needy for attention and the wrong kind of attention. And so when the tables turned and a young tagger drew this horrible caricature of Sherrod with these, you know, huge lips and sent that caricature off to the class, and it made it through probably three-fourths of the class, and they were laughing and falling out of their seats, and finally Sherrod has his comeuppance. When I grabbed that note from him, and I saw in his eyes that this kid was about to implode right there in my classroom, and I saw his humanity, and I saw this young boy ready to fall apart, and I realized that it's easier to make kids laugh with you than at you. And that's why Sherrod was this class clown. That's why he was always trying to be in on that joke rather than have that joke be aimed at him. And in this moment, that going back to that shout out to serendipity, I drew a comparison between the note and the Holocaust and propaganda art that I had seen in the Museum of Tolerance or through books I'd read about the Holocaust. And the reactions on my students stunned me. Of my students, no one had ever heard of the Holocaust. And at that moment, I tried to make this comparison of how can I engage them? How can I activate their prior knowledge? What do they know? They know violence. They know funerals and this like urban genocide of sorts. So I simply asked them if any of them had ever been shot at. And immediately, it was this chorus of every kid raising their hand, pulling up their shirts, and showing their war wounds. And so at that moment, I realized that if I want to teach my kids to be tolerant and to be accepting and to not pull out their fist or pull up that gun or, God forbid, pull up that Molotov cocktail, then maybe I need to teach stories about intolerance, starting with the Holocaust and looking at man's inhumanity. And to do so took my students and I on this odyssey that really changed the way I taught. It changed our outlook, and it has really changed our focus on how important it is to teach kids to be tolerant and to be accepting. And, you know, there's so many horrific examples of when people are not, whether it's the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia or what we saw in Bosnia-Herzegovina or what we witnessed in Rwanda with the Tutsis and the Hutu, or most recently what we've seen in the Sudan. And so that string of looking at genocides and man's inhumanity really changed the culture of my classroom.
What was their reaction when you brought out, say, a diary of Anne Frank? We're going to read this.
You know, in order to do so, I knew that the book was so powerful. I realized that I needed help. I needed to bring in Holocaust survivors who were their age at Auschwitz. I needed to take them to see Schindler's List and to see firsthand what happened during the Holocaust. I needed to take them to places like the Museum of Tolerance. And so what I started realizing is I became a better teacher when I had all of these things in my bag of tricks, because I realized that there's no one-size-fits-all to reach a kid. And if words on a page written by Anne Frank were not enough, then maybe live and in Technicolor and right in front of them could be Renee Firestone, who was Anne Frank's age when she went to Auschwitz and was a teenager like my students when she had been branded on her arm with that number as she walked through the gates that said Arbok Mach Frei leading to Auschwitz-Birkenau. And I'll never forget her looking at my students. At that point, she was in her 80s and had survived so much atrocity. And she simply said to my students, you know, I was a slave in my lifetime, but I knew that I had to survive, and I knew that I was going to make it. And then she went on to challenge my students, and she said, what is your excuse? And it was something that I realized I don't have the power to be that dramatic and to call these students out, because I didn't do the death march from Auschwitz into the Polish countryside. I was not branded. I didn't come to this country emaciated with $2 to my name. I didn't lose every living relative on this planet. And so for her to get into my students' face in such a powerful and provocative way and to say, what is your excuse? And essentially the rhetorical answer was, there are no excuses. You know, pull yourself up. Get out there, make something of yourself, is really a tribute to bringing education to life. Because to this day, Renee Firestone is this grandmother. We just had a holiday party, and the most hysterical thing is I had all of my Freedom Riders here at this holiday party, and they cranked up the music, and they're dancing, and now that Renee is actually in her 90s, Renee Firestone was in the middle of this dance floor with all of my Freedom Riders, and they were teaching her all these contemporary dance moves, this tiny little woman. And we were laughing, and we were giggling, and I think how far we've come, you know, what a cause for celebration. But to see her out of her comfort zone and to see my kids out of their comfort zone really was the leap of faith.
I wonder if you'd tell me some specifics about how the culture changed in the classroom and how lives were changed along this process. Maybe, you know, tell me about a couple of the kids themselves.
There was an agreement that I was hard fast about, that this was a hate-free zone, that when you walked into room 203, this was a safe haven. There were no stereotypes. There was no bias. There was just inclusion and this familial family of coming together and sharing and celebrating and being each other's cheerleader and helping kids with learning disabilities and helping kids understand that those mistakes that you made doesn't make you a bad person. You're going to make better choices when you know that there are better opportunities out there. And so my kids went from 0.5 GPAs or being kicked out of every classroom and every school they ever attended to getting 4.0s, to passing all of their classes and becoming the first in their families to graduate, the first in their families to go to college, the first in their families to get their bachelor's degree, their master's degree. I have so many Freedom Riders right now. Gets me really choked up, but I have so many Freedom Riders right now who are working on their PhDs and their EdDs, and they are so brilliant. And I think when I met them at age 14, they were still brilliant, but they had a PhD of the streets. And to know that we had cultivated this climate of saying, you can shoot for the moon. You can shoot for the moon, and you can rewrite your own ending. And through the process of reading Anne Frank and learning the legacy of the power of words, my students were able to rewrite their own ending, to put their thoughts and their feelings in a book, to send that book out into the world, and to know that it's being read by kids and by their parents and by teachers and folks right here in Utah is just, it's more than a simple teacher could have ever envisioned. 'Cause at my core, I'm just an ordinary person who was blessed to have an extraordinary experience with 150 kids, and I am so honored and so humbled that their legacy has lived on. They are change makers. They are teachers. They feel that they are civil rights activists. But most importantly, they are this loving group of young people who are not going to forget those lessons. You know, when I look at Renee Firestone and I realize that she is telling the story of the 12 million people who perished in the Holocaust who don't have the ability to tell their story. That's a really big burden. And she does so with dignity every single day. This Holocaust survivor tells her story every single day to anyone who will listen. I think my students feel the same kind of sense of urgency. Why are kids desperate? Why are kids standing on a ledge? Why are kids threatening to commit suicide or picking up that gun or joining gangs or doing the things that they're doing to feel that they're not invisible? And how do we let kids matter? And so I'm just really honored that this group of 150 students that I met when they were 14 years old are still in my life today. And I am still blessed to see them every single day. In fact, before I left for Utah, Sherrod came to the office, and he was heading off into the world. He was heading off to Illinois to speak to all of these kids in an urban community in the middle of Illinois. There's not one African-American that's in that classroom. But they can look at Sherrod, even though they may not look like him or talk like him or even have an experience like he had in an urban community. But they can look at him in the same way that my students looked at Renee and say, there's a lesson to be learned and there's a story to be told. And I, too, have a story. And I, too, can pick up a pen. And I, too, can rewrite my own ending. And so it's this amazing cycle of now realizing that my students are adults and they are changing the world.
We are talking with Erin Gruhl on Access Utah today. The event, sponsored by the Utah State University Emma Eccles Jones College of Education and Human Services, is tonight at 7. It's Tonight with Erin Gruhl, the Freedom Writer's Diary. At 7 o'clock, as I mentioned, Taggart Student Center, Stevenson Ballroom on the USU campus. Admission is free. All attendees are asked to bring a can of food to donate to the local food bank. The book is The Freedom Writer's Diary. The memoir is Teach from the Heart. Website for the Freedom Writers Foundation is freedomwritersfoundation.org. Just a few more minutes left in our hour with Erin Gruhl. I wonder, well, I know the answer, but I wonder if you'd talk about how these experiences are replicable. You might think, well, this is a unique experience that these kids with their teacher had, but you're dedicating your energies and the Freedom Writers Foundation to spreading these methods and hopefully these experiences.
Absolutely. Well, we started really early on after the book came out, the Freedom Writers and I, we realized we were the most functional, dysfunctional family around, and we thrive when we're together. There's a lot of laughter. There's a lot of tears. We created this foundation, and part of the work of the foundation was how do we help teachers? For every clueless Erin Gruhl out there with those polka dots and pearls, there's a good heart. And so how do we help all of those teachers reach their kids sooner and more efficiently? So we created this program that we affectionately call the Freedom Writer Teacher Program. And we have Freedom Writer teachers all over the United States. I'm so honored that we're going to have several of our Freedom Writer teachers from Utah joining us this evening at the university. And they come from places like Salt Lake City, but these teachers have made choices, and these choices have been, I want to help kids who are less fortunate. So my dear colleague Jeremy made a decision that he wanted to work with kids who were in a psychiatric youth facility, who were locked away from their family and friends and their community. What a noble decision. Jen is coming this evening with many of her students who are some of them may be undocumented. Many of them are migrant workers. Abject poverty in the state of Utah. And every day, this teacher, Jen, who's a Freedom Writer teacher, just wants these students to realize that you can be the American dream, and education is your lottery ticket. And so to have that opportunity to share this evening at the university with my colleagues who fight the good fight, and they get in the trenches, and it is definitely not easy. These Freedom Writer teachers went on to pen an incredible book by the name of Teaching Hope, and it was written by, for, and about teachers who wanted to give a voice to kids everywhere. And so I'm so proud that these two teachers who will be joining us have stories in Teaching Hope that represents the kids right here in your state, right here in Utah, giving them the dignity that they deserve and giving them the opportunity to be seen and to be heard and to matter. And so our mission now is really just helping teachers. We've created all kinds of curriculum. We are in the process of finishing a feature-length documentary called Stories from an Undeclared War that we're hoping will be released in the fall of 2012. And our mission is really simple. You know, we believe in kids, and we believe in teachers. And so I hope that for any of your listeners who decide to join us, bring some Kleenex, because I am sure it's going to be a boo-hoo fest. I'm getting all choked up just talking to you right now. But I assume that tonight will be just a beautiful celebration of what could be and what should be. And in doing so, we'll be able to look around the room and to really celebrate students and aspiring teachers and teachers alike.
And I guess the end of that part of the story, that all or most of your Freedom Riders graduated, right?
All of them. That's my big cheerleader. I was a cheerleader in high school, and so when I have the opportunity to cheerlead for my students.
It's extraordinary.
These are kids, 150 of whom did not think they would make it through their freshman year in high school. That's my big plea. They thought they would drop out before they even reached their sophomore year. So the fact that not only did they make it through their freshman, sophomore, junior, senior year, but they graduated, and they graduated with honors, and they went off to community colleges and universities and are using their GI Bill, for those of them that went into the military. It's amazing. And so we had 100% success rate, which is unheard of. And it wasn't because of me. It was because of them, because they realized we are only as strong as our weakest link. So when somebody falls down, somebody better catch them. And that was really the beauty of creating that culture in room 203, that we have to work together, we have to struggle together, and it is tough and it is scary, but we're going to do it together. Mm-hmm. And so to have 100% of my freshmen go off to college is something I would have never envisioned.
In fact, to stress that point in the epilogue to the Freedom Riders Diary, you paint a scene in Washington, D.C. They wanted to go to Washington, D.C. You took a field trip out there. They were inspired by the Freedom Riders, right, and the civil rights struggle. That's why they became the Freedom Riders. And the Lincoln Memorial, they all joined hands, symbolizing their unity.
Just thinking about that gets me teary-eyed. So my students wanted to give their stories to someone who would listen, and we decided that we would give it to the Secretary of Education. My kids had never left their city, never been on a plane, never stayed in a hotel, and we needed to find a way to get from point A to point B. How do we travel 3,000 miles away, set up a meeting with the Secretary of Education, and have him read our stories? And so we came up with these fundraising ideas. The most beautiful and symbolic was creating buttons with names of young people who had lost their innocence to violence, and they sold them. They went door to door throughout housing projects and in these gang-infested neighborhoods. And to know that Darius had 24 friends who'd been put to rest before they reached their 18th birthday, it was quite a feat for him to sell 18 to 24 buttons. And so we raised the money. We found ourselves in Washington, D.C. We gave our book to the Secretary of Education, and then my kids joined hands. And it was this surreal moment where they walked from the hotel on Pennsylvania Avenue, and they walked to the Washington Monument that in the evening was this like candle and this beacon all lit up. And as they were doing so, they were singing slave hymns. They were singing songs like We Shall Overcome and crying. And it was this powerful moment because they felt like they were following the footsteps of everyone who challenged what was before them. And one of the most poignant moments is we had stopped traffic, and this disgruntled driver rolls down his window and he yells out the window, "What are you doing?" And one of the Freedom Riders simply said, "We're changing the world." And it makes me get a little choked up just even saying that, "We're changing the world." And at that moment, they were 16 years old. And to feel that confident at 16 years old in our nation's capital that we're changing the world is pretty awe-inspiring. And so I just get to sit back and to watch this change happen. And it's like a ripple in a pond. And to know that it went from room 203 in Long Beach, California, to your incredible state and to be in Utah and to see that ripple continue, it's pretty amazing.
Finally, what's your top goal then with the Freedom Riders Foundation?
Ooh, that's a good question. I'm a teacher, dyed-in-the-wool teacher, and it's tough in political years. Teachers get beat up like emotional pinatas, and so I really want to be a voice for teachers and how noble our profession is and how difficult it is. I really want to be a voice for all kids who need someone to stand up for them. And so I'm hoping that that we stop as a country vilifying teachers. We change that paradigm and that discussion. I hope that we stop teaching to tests because kids are more than statistics and numbers and data. And so that's really my hope, is that we can humanize folks. I have seen the effects firsthand when I took my students to Auschwitz. What happens when we as a society start dehumanizing people? I saw what happened in Auschwitz. And so I would hope that as a culture, we don't dehumanize our young people. We don't dehumanize our educators. And so I'm always going to fight to give them a voice, to give them a platform, and to really celebrate them. And so I hope tonight that really is the takeaway or the call to action that everyone has that joins us this evening is a celebration or love letter to the state of education and how it should be and how it will be.
We have been talking with Erin Gruhl on Access Utah Today. The event is tonight at 7 o'clock in the Taggart Student Center Stevenson Ballroom on the Utah State University campus. Admission is free. All attendees are asked to bring a can of food to donate to the local food bank. It's presented by the Utah State University M. Eccles Jones College of Education and Human Services. Erin Gruhl, along with her students, author of The Freedom Riders' Diary, How a Teacher and 150 Teens Used Writing to Change Themselves and the World Around Them. And that was a New York Times bestseller. It was made into a movie, The Freedom Riders. And the memoir is Teach from the Heart. The foundation is the Freedom Riders Foundation at freedomridersfoundation.org. Erin Gruhl, pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's been an honor. I'm so honored and blessed that we had this opportunity to talk. And I hope that the room is busting at the seams this evening. Come one, come all. We'll break the fire codes. We'll sit in the aisle. But I just hope that it's going to be just a really lively discussion. And like I said earlier, bring some Kleenex. I'm feeling a little misty-eyed right now, so I'm sure it will continue through the presentation this evening.
At 7 o'clock tonight in the Taggart Student Center Stevenson Ballroom on the USU campus. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And tomorrow, we will be live in Milford. We'll be at the Renewable Energy Fair there. So tune in for talk about renewable energy tomorrow. Thanks for listening today to Access Utah.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1, 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1, 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1, 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1, 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1, 91.5 Logan.